very important principle is revealed to Christians in Romans 8 and verse 28. In this verse, the Apostle Paul wrote, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose." Notice that this very special blessing is only reserved for certain people, those who love God, those who are the called according to his purpose. But we have the assurance that all things work together for our ultimate good. That verse does not say that all things are good, but it says all things, and that means all things work together for our ultimate good. That principle is illustrated many times in the Bible, especially throughout the Old Testament. And one great illustration of God's providence at work is found in the book of Esther. And that's the book that we're studying right now. This evening, we want to look at the information presented in chapter 3. Let's spend just a moment in review of what we've already covered from chapters 1 and 2, because all of this information serves as stair steps, and we need to be mindful of what we've already covered to build up to a great illustration of God working all things together for the ultimate good of his people. In chapter 1, the king of Persia at the time was named Ahasuerus, and we find from this chapter that he removed Vashti from being queen. She must have been a very beautiful woman. And during one of his great feasts, he instructed his servants to bring Vashti forth so that he and his friends could admire her beauty. She refused, and the king became very angry, and she was removed from being queen. In my judgment, Vashti was right in refusing to do what the king wanted her to do. Now, the Bible teaches that women are to be in subjection to their husbands. We understand that principle. But that does not give the husband the right to demand something of his wife that he shouldn't demand. Well, I believe that Vashti was correct in refusing to do what the king wanted her to do. She paid a price for it. So keep that in mind, that, and it just doesn't seem fair, but that's the way it is many times. Even when we do something that is right, sometimes there's a price to pay for it. I think that's a practical lesson to learn from chapter 1. In chapter 2, we find, though, that another young woman was chosen to be queen in the place of Vashti. Her name was Esther. And she was a young Jewish woman who was very beautiful. Now, she had been raised by her cousin Mordecai. They were very close. And even after she became queen, she listened to Mordecai's instructions. One thing that he had told her not to do was reveal her background. She did not reveal that she was Jewish, so no one knew that. That is, among the Persians. Now, in chapter 3, we're introduced to a new character. His name is Haman. And we find that Haman came up with a plot to destroy Mordecai and Mordecai's people. That's basically the information that's presented in chapter 3. But we want to look at it in more detail. Let's look at verses 1 through 6 of Esther chapter 3, and we will see that Haman was seeking to destroy the Jews. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman. For so the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, Then was Haman full of wrath, and he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. We learn from verse 1 that this man that we're introduced to, Haman, was given a very high position in the Persian government. Now, in our way of looking at government leaders today, we would pretty much consider him to be a prime minister. He wasn't as powerful as the king, but basically he was the main ruler. The king gave him that very high position. Well, it would have been a great honor for a man to serve in that position. But the right kind of man should have been selected. There should have been a very careful search given to the man who would serve in this very high position in the Persian government. But Haman was promoted to that very high position by the king. And in verse 2, we see that the king gave a commandment for the other people in the government to bow down before Haman and show him reverence. Now that commandment came from the king. He wanted his people to bow down and reverence Haman after he was given that very high position. But Mordecai refused to do so. Now, exactly what his position was in the Persian government, we're not exactly sure, but he did have a position in the government. And he, of course, would have quite a bit of authority himself. That was a very respected position, whatever it was. Mordecai refused to do what the king commanded everyone else to do. Now, in verse 3, Mordecai was asked why he did not reverence Haman. You know, if he was the only one who wasn't bowing down before Mordecai, that would stand out. And apparently this went on for a little while, and the king's servants asked Mordecai why he did not show reverence to Haman. Well, that's an interesting question. If the king commanded it, then the king expected that to be done. But Mordecai refused to do so. Well, in verse 4, we see that the king's servants talked to Mordecai about this on a daily basis. So apparently this was a matter of great importance to them. But he still, that is Mordecai, did not bow down before Haman. He was asked about this repeatedly, but he would not give in. Well, let's think about why Mordecai did what he did. Well, for one thing, Mordecai had told these people that he was a Jew. Now, he told Esther not to tell anyone that she was a Jewess, but he did reveal that he was a Jew. Remember that. And you have to keep some historical facts in mind. The Babylonians had taken the Jews into captivity. That lasted 70 years. The Persians and the Medes conquered the Babylonians. They allowed the Jews who wanted to go back to their homeland to do so, and many of them did, and they eventually rebuilt the temple. But many people stayed in what is now Persia. And Mordecai is among those Jews who stayed in the land of captivity. They were allowed to go back if they desired, but they were not forced to. King Cyrus gave an official command that if anyone wanted to, they were allowed to go back to Jerusalem. And he understood that, I believe from Scripture, that it was God's intention that his temple be rebuilt. Well, we have to admire Cyrus for that. But now, Ahasuerus is the king of Persia. Well, Mordecai did inform the Persians that he was a Jew. Well, there are certain things we need to keep in mind in that regard. The Jews did show respect to kings. I think a few scriptures will help us understand that Haman was expecting Mordecai to do something that was in conflict with the law of Moses. Mordecai was a Jew, and that being the case, he was obligated to obey the law of Moses. But we find that although the king commanded Mordecai and all the other officials to bow down before Haman, Mordecai would not do it. Let's look at a few scriptures. Let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 14 and read verse 4. And when the woman of Tekoa spake to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and did obeisance and said, "Help, O king." Now here's a woman who approached King David. And as she did so, she fell to the ground and she did obeisance. That is, she showed respect to David because he was king. Now keep in mind that Joab at the time was trying to make a point with King David concerning his son Absalom. And he was using this woman to try to make the point. But when she approached David, she fell to the ground and she did obeisance. That is, she showed respect to King David. Let's look also at chapter 18 and verse 28. And Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, "All is well." And he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king and said, "Blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king." Here again we have an illustration of someone living under the law of Moses showing reverence to the king. Now we're trying to establish the fact that Haman was expecting something more than just respect. Well, we need to keep in mind that although the Jews did show respect to the government leaders, they were not allowed to show respect or worship for anyone or any image that belonged only to God. Let's look at Exodus chapter 20. We're reading from the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, let's start at verse 3. "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me." Concerning reverence that belonged only to God, that was not to be shown to any person or anything or any image. Now, how does all this play into what's going on between Mordecai and Haman? It certainly appears that Haman desired more than respect. I can't help but think that the king commanded all the other officials to show respect to Haman, but I believe Haman was expecting a lot more. I think he wanted people to worship him. And Mordecai knew that that was a violation of the law of Moses, and he would not. I think it's interesting that on another occasion, there were three young Jewish men who refused to bow down before a great image, although the king had commanded it to be done. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stood their ground, and the Lord blessed them. And they made quite an impression upon the old Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar. Well, it certainly appears from what's revealed to us in these other verses that Haman was wanting much more than just respect. We have clear examples of the Jewish people showing respect to government leaders, including kings. However, worship that's directed only to God is not to be shown to anyone else. And you know, I have read in history accounts about some great, so-called great political leaders who have considered themselves to be gods. I believe there was a problem with that in Egypt. I believe the leader of Japan was considered to be divine. That's something we're familiar with. I can't help but think that Haman wanted people to look up to him as some type of divine being. No, he wasn't. Mordecai realized that that would have been a sin, and he refused to do it. You know, you have to admire a man who will stand up for what he believes and be determined to do what is right, knowing that there's a price probably to be paid for it. Well, Haman was told about what Mordecai was doing. So Haman learned that Mordecai refused to bow down before him. It would have been one thing if Haman had talked to Mordecai and said, "What's the problem? Is there something we can straighten out? What's the reason that you don't bow down before me?" Haman did not react like that, and that gives us an indication of what kind of man he was. He became very angry when Mordecai would not bow down before him. Now, all of this information is setting the stage for God working all things together for the good of his people. How did Haman then react? He wanted to kill Mordecai, but that wasn't sufficient. He wanted to kill all of Mordecai's people. Now, there were quite a few Jews still in the land of captivity. Haman wanted to destroy all of them. Why? Because one man refused to bow down before him. Well, this is helping us understand what kind of man Haman was. Have you ever noticed that sometimes people who do not have any business being leaders of people somehow get in those positions? That's been a problem for a long, long time. Well, let's look at verse 7. This is back in Esther 3. Verse 7 says, "In the first month, that is, the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman from day to day, and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is, the month Adar." Okay? A time was set for destroying Mordecai and his people. Now, that's what Haman wants. He's angry at Mordecai because he would not bow before him. He not only wants to kill Mordecai, but Haman wants to destroy all of Mordecai's people, speaking about the Jews. And the timing of this, I believe, was very interesting. There had to be a time set for carrying that out. And we read about casting Pur. Many times you read in the Bible about casting lots. That was a way that certain decisions were made. And that was what was done. There had to be a time selected for destroying all of the Jews, and the time was the first month. And I want you to notice that the month that was selected, they went from month to month to month, and finally, the 12th month was selected as the time for destroying all of the Jews. But according to verse 13, let's read it. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Okay. The lot was cast in the first month. The time selected was the 13th day of the 12th month. Now that's interesting. That would give almost an entire year for God to work things out for the good of his people. Now, he doesn't need that much time, but I can't help but think that he was behind this date being selected. It gave the Jewish people a sufficient amount of time to deal with this situation. They're all going to be eradicated in one day. That date was chosen. But it was going to be about a year from when the date was actually selected. Well, Haman, in his position, similar to a prime minister, convinced the king that the Jews ought to be destroyed. I'm sure he would have had authority to do pretty much whatever he wanted to do. But being a political figure, it would be much more expedient if he had the king's approval. Well, let's notice what happened. Verse 8. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and sealed with the king's ring. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. The post went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. According to verse 8, when Haman approached the king, he talked about certain people. And he said that these certain people in your kingdom are bad. Their laws are different from your laws, and they don't serve any good purpose. You ought to just get rid of them. Now that's a general term. There are certain people. Did he identify the ones that he wanted to destroy? No, he didn't. But he gave a general description of some people that the king would assume would be enemies to him. But they were not. Now this is Haman wanting authority from the king to do what he wanted to do, that is to destroy all of the Jewish people. So he told the king that there were certain people in his kingdom who were bad, and it would serve no good purpose to keep them around. In verse 9, Haman then made a suggestion. He suggested that the king give a law to destroy those people. Now this is important because if the king caused a law to be effected, it could not be altered. We've already established that. That's one of the things about the laws of the Medes and the Persians. It could not be altered. Once it became effective, it could not be altered or changed. Well, you can see what Haman's trying to do. He's trying to get the king to make a law that all these people would be destroyed at a particular time. And how does the king respond? Well, the king gave his ring to Haman. That would serve as a seal. Once the ring was perhaps placed in some type of ink and stamped on the document, then that made it official. But notice that Haman offered to pay all the expenses. I think that's very interesting. Now, he didn't, but that's what he offered. He offered to pay the expenses involved in eradicating Mordecai's people. Now, notice that he didn't identify Mordecai at this time. He said there are certain people. Well, that's just a general expression, and the king should have pursued that matter, but he didn't. We'll talk about that more a little bit later. But the king gave his ring to Haman. In other words, that law was to be written, and it would become effective. But then as we read in verse 11, the king not only provided the money, but he provided the people to do what Haman wanted to do, that is to eradicate the Jews. We learn from verse 12 that this request made by Haman became an official written law, meaning it could not be changed. Well, the people throughout the empire needed to learn about this. We learn from verses 13 and 14 that letters were sent throughout the whole empire. Now, Ahasuerus ruled over a large number of people over a large area of land. Letters were sent throughout the empire stating that all the Jews were to be destroyed on that particular day, that is the 13th day of the 12th month. But at the end of verse 15, the king and Haman were happy, but notice how the rest of the people felt. The rest of the people were confused. Now, why did I say that the king and Haman were happy? The verse says they sat down to drink. But the rest of the people were not so happy. They were confused. Well, this is a pretty difficult situation. Let's make a few observations. And as we do so, I think there are some lessons we need to be reminded of. Let's first talk about the king for a minute or two. He's already demonstrated his weakness, but he's done it again. He allowed this man Haman to manipulate him and to use him. I don't know about you, but there's something that I've got a very low tolerance for, and that's for someone manipulating somebody else. I've seen that done over the years, And I've just got a very low tolerance for that. I've got no use for it. The Bible forbids us to treat others like that. But Haman manipulated the king. But we have to point the finger also at the king, because the king allowed himself to be manipulated. So by doing so, he's demonstrating his weakness as a leader of his people. I've always thought it was kind of interesting that the king did not ask who these certain people were. You know, if such a serious charge was brought up against somebody, I'd want to know who it was referring to. The king didn't do that. He did not ask who these certain people were. And the king did not take a careful look at this situation to determine if these accusations from Haman were accurate. If he'd just taken a little bit of time and done some inquiring, perhaps he could have figured things out. And the king did not know it at this point, who would have been included when the Jews were destroyed. Queen Esther. She was Jewish. But at that point, she had not revealed to anyone that she was Jewish. But when this command to destroy all the Jews went into effect, that would include Esther, the woman that the king had chosen to be his new queen. Well, let's talk about a foolish decision that the king made. He made a foolish decision when he appointed Haman to such a high position. I'm kind of curious about the background of Haman and the king, how the king, you know, knew about Haman and what Haman had perhaps done in the past to get the king's attention. That information isn't revealed to us. But the king made a very foolish decision when he appointed Haman to such a high position. As we've already mentioned, Haman was a manipulator. He was using the king to do what he wanted, that is to destroy Mordecai and his people. That's sad to me, but that tells us something about Haman. He should never have been appointed to this position, but he was. I think we can also see that Haman was quite proud and he was quite vain. Let's see what the wise man had to say about that in Proverbs chapter 8. Let's read verse 13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate. How does God feel toward pride? Well, this passage is very clear in saying that God hates it. Haman had a problem with pride. He demanded that the king commanded that everyone bow down before Haman. And when Mordecai refused to do so, Haman's pride got the best of him. He not only wanted to destroy Mordecai, but all of his people as well. Look also at Proverbs 16 and verse 18. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Now keep that verse in mind as we go through our study, because Haman was certainly lifted up with pride. He was a vain man, and he suffered a fall. Well, Solomon dealt with Haman's situation a long time before he ever came on the scene. I think we can also see, as we examine what took place, that Haman had a heart that was filled with hatred. Let's notice once again what the wise man had to say about that in Proverbs chapter 26. Let's start at verse 24. He that hateth dissembleth with his lips and layeth up deceit within him. When he speaketh fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart, whose hatred is covered by deceit. His wickedness shall be showed before the whole congregation. Eventually, Haman's hatred would be seen by everyone. He'd pay a high price for it. You know, a lot of heartache could have been avoided if Haman had just sat down with Mordecai and asked him why he refused to bow down before him. That would have given Mordecai an opportunity to explain what the law of Moses taught. And perhaps Haman could have learned a thing or two. But he was so filled with pride, he was such a vain man, and he had so much hatred inside of him, that he was intent on not only destroying Mordecai, but all of his people. Well, we're setting the stage for God working all things together for the good of his people. Now, concerning Romans 8 and verse 28, and I always like to tie this in, that passage does not say that everything that happens to God's people are good. I think we've just seen that illustrated. As a matter of fact, some evil things have just happened to God's chosen people. Haman has gotten a law to become official which said that all the Jews were to be destroyed. But I don't think Haman had any respect for God. He apparently had no knowledge of what God's law has to say. But he's going to learn eventually that God is in control. Well, I don't think we'll be going through situations like the Jews were facing at the time. But if things continue to progress in our society as they are, Christians have some difficult days to look forward to. I hope that's not the case, but that just might be the case. We have to rely upon God to see us through. We need to remember that great principle in Romans 8 and verse 28. And Paul, the apostle, said, "We know." He didn't say, "We think," "We guess," "We hope." He said, "We know." How do we know that? Well, for one thing, God said so. For another thing, we see that principle illustrated over and over again. That's one reason why I love to study the Old Testament, because we have these great illustrations of God's providence at work.